there we are. Okay, can you hear me in the back? No? Yes? Yes, you can. Somebody raise a hand if you can hear me in the back. No? Okay. Okay, let's try that. Now, can you hear me in the back? Raise a hand if you can. Anybody hear me in the back? No. And how do you know I was asking? Anybody have a gray cat? Ah, now can you hear me in the back? No. Raise a hand if you can hear me loud and clear in the back. All right. We'll just keep going up. How's that? I'm going to start echoing in a minute. Now can you hear me? Yeah. All right. Good. Thank you. Hi. Welcome to Monday, the 19th. Anybody else spend the day fighting their crashing computer? I am a grown-up. I am a guy. I do not cry. Yet. Soon, but I'm not yet. Questions? No questions from the crowd. Okay. Well, I'll see if I can stir up some. Let's see what I can do here. We were talking about adaptations at birth, just to remind you. This baby is adapting, I'm not sure how. And we had talked about the child coming into the world with the physical foundation for social interaction. And I had talked specifically about vision and the fact that infants, newborns, come into the world able to discriminate at a fairly well-developed level, but unable to accommodate, that is to change focal length, and that they come with a fixed focal length of about 10 to 12 inches, and we describe the potential reasons for that, or at least the advantages of that, as being that's about the distance away mother's face is going to be when you're nursing, or a father's face if you're feeding from a bottle, and about the distance that your hands are going to be away from your eyes, so that you can see those two really important aspects of the world, mother's face or caregiver's face and your own hands. You can see those quite clearly while everything else is out of focus. And I mentioned that babies prefer to look at things that are moderately complex and most of all prefer things that have about the same degree of detail as faces. And ideally, they like to look at faces. And the more real the image is, the better. It is the more attractive it is. We also talked about hearing and a parallel finding that babies come able to hear and to discriminate sounds, very quickly become able to localize sounds, and that they're most sensitive in the range of sounds that encompasses the human voice. And they prefer to listen to sounds that are like voices, that have the same kind of up and down modulation rather than a steady tone. They prefer things that have these sorts of overtones that voices have rather than clear signals or clear tones, or what we call square tones that don't have any overtones in them. And at the end of class, I was suggesting that babies are aroused by or stimulated by voices that are in the high range of human production, typically the soprano range, that all of us go through when we're trying to attract a baby and get its attention and wake it up, and that they are calmed by or soothed by the low voices that we tend to use when we sing lullabies. That distinction between the arousability by high tones and the use of low tones for calming persists through the rest of the lifespan. So many of us find very high voices to be distracting and annoying, and most of us learn when we want to help somebody calm down, when we want to be helping a person relax, when we want to help a person deal with emotions, when we want a person to trust us, we tend to drop our voices. There's an important lesson in that. If you listen to your own voice and it's really high, and you're in a profession or a situation where you want people to pay attention to you and respond positively, it's often helpful to take some voice lessons and learn to control the pitch. And if your voice is particularly high, to lower the pitch, stretch your vocal cords out a little bit, get the breath above, you know, the pear-shaped tones that we all learn in singing. Your voice will, if it's unattractive or highly arousing, that is stimulating unpleasantly to people, it will get in the way of communication. Okay, so that's picking up from where we left. And the third characteristic of babies that I wanted to talk about briefly is that they come prepared to respond to touch, and to respond to touch by attempting to adjust their own bodies in response to being held. So what we see is that babies are responsive to molding them, tucking them in your arm, stroking them, smooth stimulation and rhythmic movement. Okay. So rocking a baby takes advantage of the fact that babies like gentle stimulation, they like rhythmic stimulation, they like to be touched, and they like to have their bodies stimulated in a way that they find pleasing. So all of the massage, the smooth rubbing, the use of the palm of your hand to mold a baby's body and follow its shape gets a baby's attention and helps it relax in the same way that a massage relaxes you, or cuddling makes you feel good. Babies are responsive to warmth and comfort, especially when they're fussy. They soothe, they calm down, and they focus their attention when you hold them in ways that they're comfortable with. They also begin to very early engage in reciprocal responses and actions. So it's an adaptation that parents or caregivers and babies make together. So very early on, when you touch a baby and stimulate it, babies tend to respond to that, and parents tend to respond by repeating the action, or caregivers tend to repeat it. And they set up a reciprocity of motion and body movement that becomes a game. And caregivers who do that become more familiar quickly to babies and have more effectiveness in soothing them and in helping them explore the environment. So babies come prepared to respond to being held, to being touched, to being rhythmically stimulated, and to respond to the activities that move their bodies. So if you take the child's hand and squeeze it, the babies will squeeze back. If you move the arm to one side, babies will move it back and then wait for you to bring it back. And those are established within the first 2 or 3 days. So these are tendencies that babies come with. They form the basis of games, and they are what we would find in the expectable environment. And in all three ways, in vision and in hearing and in touch, babies come having evolved to respond in ways that caregivers are going to expect and that will enable the baby to sort out who the important people are in the environment and to establish reciprocity and familiarity with them. Babies that don't respond in any of these three ways or who don't have the tuned equipment that we expect strike us as odd. So if you are interacting with a newborn who is deaf, for example, the baby's failure to respond to sound by orienting or alerting or by soothing, that baby is not responding in a way that the caregiver expects. And if you're not aware that the baby is deaf, then it strikes you as unresponsive. And that can become a barrier in creating familiarity and comfort with the baby. Similarly, blind babies don't respond as we expect babies to. And it's very difficult to establish the initial contact and familiarity with a blind baby because it can't anticipate you. It can't focus on you. It won't be able to follow you with its eyes, all things that we expect babies to do. And if you don't talk to a baby that can't see, if you don't talk to it so that it can localize you, so it can figure out where you are and where it should focus, because it will localize the sound, if you don't talk to it, then you put yourself in the position of regularly startling it. So the problem that caregivers who aren't particularly vocal have is that they're constantly startling the baby by touching it. You swoop in, you pick it up. If you don't talk to it before you do that, then you've got a baby that is suddenly upset. And that is a barrier to creating the caregiver and child relationship. Similarly, babies who don't mold, and there are babies who don't like to be held, who don't like to be confined, who don't like to have the caregiver rock it, those babies struggle, and they don't respond appropriately, and parents begin to think, or caregivers begin to think very quickly, that the baby doesn't like me. It resists. It stiffens. What we like and what we expect is the baby that we can pick up, and it goes, That's what we expect, and most babies do that. But if you pick up a baby and try to do that and it goes, then it's creating a barrier to what you hope will become a positive relationship. There are sex differences, very small ones. The biggest one in vision and hearing and how rapidly they mature, but not big enough to worry about. The one that might be significant is the touch response of male and female newborns. Female newborns are a little bit more responsive to fine touch, the small touch. It takes less touch to get their attention. You have to stimulate, use a bigger stimulus, more powerful stimulus, to get the boy baby's attention. And girl babies don't like sudden displacement. So if you move a baby rapidly or jerkily and get the baby to respond negatively, i.e. crying, girls are likely to cry more quickly. Boys are more likely to respond to that with curiosity. Huh, what the heck is going on? And as they develop, that difference continues, and boy babies, on average, and all sex differences are on average, boy babies are more aroused and comfortable with large displacements. So if you swing your baby up and down and it's a girl, it's likely to start fussing. If you do the boy the same way, he may say, hey, this is great, keep on doing it. I'll stop there on sex differences. You're not really interested in how the sexes are different. So, okay. Now, we've got this baby out. It's prepared for social interaction. It's ready for the expectable environment. The caregivers around it are going to respond in ways that will develop reciprocity and a comfortable routine with the baby. Now, the baby has been active in utero. And as I said last week, boy babies are more active in utero than girl babies, especially in the last 3 or 4 months, considerably more active. But both boy and girl babies move. And they continue to move, and they continue to exercise all parts of the body. So we see random movement. That's reflex movement. It's just there. And babies get excited and wiggle. They get uncomfortable, and they stretch. They move. And over time, that exercise or activity is very important. It's important because it does all these things, and I'll get the last one up there in a minute. Okay. The movement is important for strengthening muscles and ligaments. It stimulates bone growth and increases bone density. Okay. So these things begin or continue after birth and are important, and they continue right on up through adolescence and beyond. And so exercise stimulates muscle development at any point in the lifespan. Exercise stimulates bone growth and increases bone density across the lifespan and is important. It also affects the brain. It's consolidating pathways in the brain. It's helping make connections. It leads to voluntary control of the actions and functions. So over time, what the baby is doing is watching its own movement. It's responding to that movement and gradually making it intentional. So it's doing things that were involuntary when it was starting to move, and it's beginning to develop the pathways in the brain that let it control its movement. And it can only do that, can only create those pathways and gain the control by exercise. It has to practice. And activity is that practice. So we want babies to be active and to pay attention to their own actions and gradually build up the control of all the parts of the body, which will be a gradual process. As it develops the voluntary control, it's also differentiating specific movements and specific parts of the body for those movements. Remember that, I'll put the overhead back up in a minute, we talked about the importance of differentiation and integration. The baby's initial movements and activity is pretty uncoordinated. It's pretty global. So I move the whole arm at once, both legs at once. It'll scrunch up its whole body. It'll move everything, and it's pretty random. What the baby's going to do over the first many months is figure out that it has two arms, by golly, and they're controlled separately. And you can move them together, but you can also differentiate them and move one at a time. Each arm is composed of a number of parts, and each part can be moved separately. So at the beginning, the baby moves its arm, and it's pretty random. Where it wants to go, eventually, is to be able to reach for an object and pluck it out of the air. Flies, for example. Some of you like to catch flies, no? Grab them. How do you do that? What you started with is an arm that is pretty uncontrolled. What the baby has to do is differentiate each part. The shoulder joint is separate from the elbow. And that's separate from the wrist. And that's separate from each digit. And each digit is separable from the other. And that's about as far as I go. I can, if I work at it. If I practiced a lot, I would be able to bend each digit separately, but that's hard. Showing my motor lack of skill. But eventually, the baby's going to differentiate each of those joints and each direction so that it can move its elbow one way while it moves its wrist the other and change the position of its arm so that you can pick up a glass, hold it over your head, put it on your head without turning it upside down. Don't try that with your two-year-old, because the two-year-old will pick up the glass without being able to differentiate the rotator in the wrist and go, it's a challenge. Do this Saturday night, late. Encourage your roommate to pick up a full glass of water and place it on his or her head without spilling it. Okay? It's an interesting motion, but you can do it. Well, some of you can do it. It's a pretty complicated process. What babies do is exercise each possible movement and gradually gain control. And coordinate that with the accommodation in their eyes so that they can watch a moving target, reach up, anticipate where it's going, figure out how big and heavy it is with enough practice, and pass it from one hand to the other, or take it out of your hand while you're moving it past them. And so you've got the spoon going this way, and the kid can reach up and anticipate it and grab it out of your hand and splash turnips all over you. Every differentiation that the baby makes in movement, every bit of voluntary control it establishes is based on multiple differentiations of parts of the body and creating pathways in the brain that allow it to voluntarily adjust each part of its body separately and then integrate them into coordinated movement. And we'll come back with some examples of that. I mentioned putting the eyes and the hands together, integrating sensory input with motor activity. We're allowing repetition of interesting actions and the results, which is why babies do these wonderful, idiotic things that they repeat over and over again. As they're exercising, they will do the same thing over and over and over again, and it looks like we've got a young child with perseveration problems, but as the child is exercising, it's going to repeat the same thing over and over again for exactly the same reason that you go to the driving range and hit 100 golf balls with the same driver, because you're repeating that action and making it voluntary and getting control over it. Or why you go to the batting cage and let the batting machine pitch 200 baseballs at you while you do nothing but swing at them. The baby is repeating the same action over and over again to create the familiarity and eventually be able to coordinate that motion and make it voluntary. Babies spend a lot of time doing that practice and spend a lot of energy. Those actions also, the activity that the baby is engaging in, elicit reciprocal responses from other people. So if you do the same thing over and over again, people will respond to you and you can create games. And when you can do those things voluntarily, you become, as a baby, in control of the interaction that you're having with the adults. One of the early forms of control of the relationship that babies develop is that they can initiate actions that they have learned will elicit a response from the adult. And they practice that. The baby sits in the high chair and pushes the dish of applesauce off the tray. And it does that accidentally at first. Hey, that was fun. And is startled by it. And then studies the motion. Oh, here comes a dish again. Huh. Let's see, last time I pushed that off. Let's see what happens this time. And you do that half a dozen times, or a dozen times, or 15 times, or 20 times. And if you haven't been abused yet, what you're doing is setting up an expectation that when you knock that dish off, or you pick your own behavior, but when you knock that dish off, you're going to create some kind of response in mother. And as you get older, you're going to get more and more control. So, here's dad feeding you. I wonder if he responds the same way. Puts the dish on the tray. And then you can see that the child is experimenting. Let's do this slowly. Let's see how close I can get to the edge. Let's see if I can just hesitate right here until dad gets to the point where he's too far away to stop me, but he's still looking at me. And then I'm going to look at dad, and then I'm going to push it off, and I'm going to watch what he does. Okay? That's learning about the world, both the physical world and the social world, and being in charge of initiating the interaction that you have with the parent. Later in the psychosocial unit, the third unit, we'll talk about how babies use that kind of knowledge that they've developed to get back at you. But there's a difference between the baby who's experimenting and making it a familiar action and a baby who is deliberately doing it because he's pissed at you. Okay. So babies do get pissed at their parents, they do get annoyed, they do get frustrated, and they do engage in behaviors that they can make voluntary that will retaliate, but not in the first year. They don't retaliate early on in life. But it is, the activity is the foundation for continued psychosocial development. The activity is also the way the baby learns about the features of the physical world. Okay? So, a whole bunch of consequences of activity, and activity and watching are the two things that babies do most of. And through the watching, they develop their understanding of the visual world. Through the action, they develop their understanding of both their own movements and the characteristics of the physical world. What can you move? What can you not move? How do you move it? All important knowledge. Okay, let's go back a minute. I want to talk about brains briefly, and pick up on the one comment on that first over the previous overhead, which is that activity creates connections and pathways in the brain. What's going on? Well, this is the fetal brain. It's pretty primitive at 25 days, and then it gradually gets larger and differentiates into different parts. The major distinction that is important to think about is that we have a very early developed primitive brain which takes care of our physical functions. And that's very similar to most other species in what kinds of parts it has, at least relatively complex species. And then we have a cortex. I can do that, okay. It has a cortex which surrounds it. And the cortex is a later evolution which we share with more developed organisms. And that's the part of the brain that is going to be used for thinking, for changing our behavior, for adaptation, for developing language, abstract thinking, problem solving, our understanding of war and peace and those sorts of things. But brain development is not complete at birth. The brain will continue to develop, and it will develop more complexity. It will develop and mature up into your 20s, and it will continue to change gradually after that. But it's not complete at birth, and the behavior and the development of people is quite dependent on the further development of that brain. The brain is a complex organ. It changes in at least 8 ways. The text describes some of these, and I'm going to elaborate a bit. The brain gets bigger. It gets bigger for several reasons. The brain gets more organized, and it gets organized in several ways. The first thing that's happening in the brain is cell genesis, and that begins early on in embryonic life. And cell genesis refers to the proliferation of neurons. That happens in two particular areas of the brain in the embryonic period. And it's interesting that, to me anyway, that those two areas where the cells are being generated, one is specific to the old part of the brain, and the other is specific to the cortex. And they are different kinds of cells. So all the cells in your brain are not the same, and you have two areas early on in embryonic life where cells are being generated. The stem cells, neural stem cells, are dividing and creating new cells. At one point, I think the text says, at about 250,000 a minute during the peak period of brain growth. What do you do with the cells after they develop? Well, in the primitive part of the brain, they kind of grow up like mushrooms. And I'm going to undim my lights here for a moment. Return to menu, and more, lights. There we go. So I want to draw this on the board. What happens in the primitive part of the brain is that the cells keep dividing, and as you're creating them in the substrate area, the place where they're being generated, they just keep dividing and they keep pushing cells out so that the organs surrounding the areas of genesis get bigger. But what's happening is that the new cells are just pushing the old ones farther and farther out, like the development of a mushroom. And as they get pushed out, they continue to grow and then gradually start making connections to other parts of the brain. In the cortex, what happens is that the cells are generated and two things happen. One is that a series of threads of different kinds of cells go out from the place where the cells are being generated. And then as cells are generated, they migrate. The cells literally each along those threads. They migrate out to where they're going to end up. And genetically, they know, and the developing brain knows, where those cells are going to end up. So migration is important in enlarging the brain and in organizing it, because different kinds of cells migrate to different places to create that eventual cortex. And the cells that move into particular areas will develop specialization for particular actions. Okay. Now, let me do a little parenthesis here and talk about one of the ways that you can mess up a brain while it's developing. And that is to mess up migration. If you stop the cell genesis, and you can do that, you can do it by poisoning the brain, you can do it by starving the brain, it's just not going to generate, then you're not going to have brain cells at all. That's pretty serious. You can also mess up migration. And there are two kind of classic examples of ways that's been done. One is by radiation. In Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan, there were pregnant women, and we dropped the atomic bombs on them. They were subjected to massive doses of radiation. Many of them died, but some of them didn't. Some of the ones who didn't die experienced stillbirth, but some of them didn't. And there was a relatively small group of pregnant women who went on to complete their pregnancies and deliver children. And those children have a variety of problems. Some of them, very few, but many of them, rather serious problems. One of the problems is represented by a group of babies, all of whom were about at the same stage when the bombs were dropped. And I don't have the specific date, but it was a period during which the cortex was being formed and migration was taking place. What happened was that the radiation stopped the migration. So cells continued to be generated, but they didn't go anywhere. And these children grew up, They're now, however old they are, many of them are still alive. They're profoundly retarded. They don't do abstract thinking. They don't do numbers. There are a whole bunch of things that they don't do because they don't have organized cortexes that allow them to deal with that input. And it's very clearly a case where the radiation halted the migration and caused the distortion in the brain that led to the retardation. Second example is one we still see. Doesn't require anything as dramatic as an atomic bomb. And that's a condition in which migration doesn't get halted. It keeps right on going. What happens is the cells don't know when to stop. So they just keep on growing, going. And in parts of the brain, they make messes out at the surface of the brain. Sometimes they keep on growing, going, migrating, until they go beyond where you ought to have brain. So they're out there on what would be the surface and create lumps on the external surface of the brain. What would make somebody not know when to stop? I mean, a brain cell. Not know when to stop. Alcohol. The damage done in fetal alcohol syndrome, which babies have been exposed to alcohol in utero, more than enough, too many drinks over too much time, the damage done, which is often characterized by impulsiveness and retardation, mild to severe, difficulty in processing many kinds of information, it takes many forms, that consequence is the consequence of messing up the migration so that the cells keep right on migrating. They don't stop where they're supposed to. So you end up with a messy, disorganized cortex. And the more alcohol or the longer period of time, the messier it is. So migration has to take place in a way that is systematic and organized and leads to cortical cells being in the right places so they can make connections with other cortical cells and perform the functions that they have evolved to perform. So you can mess up the migration by stopping it. Radiation is the best example. You can mess it up by not inhibiting it. So it's uninhibited. It just willy-nilly, you know, just like everybody you know who drinks too much. You can blame it on lack of inhibition in their brain cells. That, don't chase that analogy too far. Yeah, but that's why alcohol is not good for babies in utero. Okay, let me come back to the ways the brain changes. It increases in cell size. Cells that are generated are primitive cells. They don't have much body. They don't have a lot of connection. And gradually the cell size increases as the cells continue to develop. The brain changes by making connections. Cells communicate with each other. And each cell sends out projections, axons, and dendrites, two kinds of projections, that end up touching the projections of other cells and creating synapses. That's the place where cells communicate with each other chemically. As you develop those connections, you develop more of the axons and dendrites, and the cell gets bigger. And as the cells get bigger and there are more connections, it gets heavier and thicker. And so it gets denser. You look at the thousands of connections that cells have with each other, you can see that it's a very, very complex web of cell connections. And the more enriched your environment, the more connections you make. But one of the differences between monkeys that you raise in an impoverished intellectual environment with not much to do and monkeys that have a rich environment with lots of things to explore and new things introduced regularly is that their cortexes, the thinking part of the brain, are more densely connected in the monkeys that have been raised in a rich environment. And presumably the same is true in people as well. Cells die. Another way the brain changes. You actually have more cells, more brain cells, when you're born than you will later. And they start dying off. And as they die off, there's a logic to it. Cells that aren't needed. Cells that aren't making connections to other cells. Cells that are unstimulated tend to die off. Staying alive turns out to be the result of being used. So for a cell, it's use me or lose me. But some cells are instructed to die because they're in the way. And there are chemical signals that cells send to each other, one of which is a signal that says, not dead. And they do. They wither and are absorbed. Synapses also are lost. And so you have two kinds of pruning. Cell pruning, or apoptosis, the cells die, and synaptic pruning, where synapses, the connections between cells that are not used or are superfluous, wither away. So cells lose some of their connections over time, and particularly if you're not using those connections. But one of the reasons that the cell pruning and the synaptic pruning happen is because you're creating pathways or circuits. And you want those circuits to be as effective and efficient as possible. And sometimes the excess cells or the excess connections are interfering with the functioning of a particular cell circuit, the cell assembly. So the brain gets rid of those that are interfering. And as you exercise a particular assembly, for example, the assembly that is helping you control your arms, as you're exercising that set of arms, you're exercising the pathways in the brain, and as you make the movement more efficient, you may be reducing the number of cells that you need, and you may be creating consolidated pathways from those cells and cell assemblies to others. So I need to get, for example, the information from my eyes and my hands together. So I have good eye-hand coordination. That requires connecting parts of two very, very separate parts of the body and the brain, the visual cortex and the motor cortex. They're in different parts. I need to make connections between them. And to make those connections efficient, I may need to get rid of some of the cells or the connections that aren't being useful for that. And finally, the eighth way that the brain changes is that it gets insulated. The nerve cells, the axons and dendrites, develop a fatty sheath, cholesterol-based sheath called myelin, around them. And that happens in different parts of the brain at different times. And what happens is that we see better coordination of the skills that are based on a particular part of the brain as that part of the brain becomes myelinized. And that myelination process continues up into your 20s. Some of you are right now developing connections in your brain that represent your knowledge of brain development, and you're understanding it more efficiently because that part of your brain that deals with complex sets of changes is being myelinized. The last part of the brain that we're aware of that is fully myelinized is the part of the brain that lets you deal with complex systems of ideas, the most abstract thinking that you do. And that's the part that myelinizes during your late teens and early 20s. Oh, anybody want a Nobel Prize? Here's a Nobel Prize question. Does myelinization just happen on a timetable? And so your behavior is going to follow the myelination of your brain. Or does activity and exercise stimulate the myelination? We don't know. Just one of those things. Myelination happens, we know it, but we don't know if it's responsive to the activity, so that being challenged in high school and college to think about complex systems might encourage the myelination of that part of the brain and stimulate it to happen more quickly. Or does it just happen and your thinking come along with that? That's the it's not a $64,000 question anymore. It's $1 million question. 1.2, I think, is the latest round of Nobel Prizes, 1.2 million. Okay? So the brain is changing in many ways. And as it does that, it's getting much more complex and much more organized. Oh, here, let me do a couple of... There's the process of myelinization, and this is the... Looks kind of like a sausage on a stick, doesn't it? Okay. You bought one of those at the fair. And just like the ones at the fair, it's made out of fat. A lot of fat. There's the neuron. It has a nucleus. It sends out axons and dendrites. And the myelin builds up along those. The consequence of the myelin is that the signal from cell to cell is passed along more efficiently. There's less confusion by it during that processing. Okay, that's an interesting picture to think about for a minute. Let me... let me do it this way. I want to call attention to the fact that real brains are more complex than that. Let me do it this way. I'll draw it instead of bringing it to life. Like that color? Okay. At birth, you're going to have about 100 billion neurons. 100 billion. That's a whole bunch. And gradually that number is going to decrease. Eventually, you're going to get down to about 50 billion. That's what you probably have now. Because you've lost half your brain. But your brain has improved and grown in those other ways. Now, each of those cells, one cell, is likely to have anywhere from 5,000 to 100,000 connections to other cells. Okay, so the picture, this one, makes it look like the neuron has some connections, but you could probably count them. In the real brain, each cell has from 5,000 to 100,000 connections to other cells. Now, if we take that conservatively and think about 50 billion, let's see, 50, 1, 2, 3, that's 50,000, 50 million, 50 billion. Okay. 50 billion cells times, let's say, just 5,000 connections. Let's go with the low number. To 250 trillion connections. That's the low end estimate. 250 trillion connections. So, something like that. How many different pathways can you make with 250 or 500 trillion different connections? Question? Is that for the total brain? Yes. Yeah. You can do a lot of things with 250 trillion connections. That's more than the number of cell phones on Earth. Okay. Thank you for indulging me that. Now, what happens with that brain in childhood? I'm going to talk briefly about two periods during which there are changes. The brain is going to keep changing, and around the middle of the second year, 16 to 18 months, maybe a little earlier, one of the changes that it's going to undergo is that it's going to lateralize. What does that mean? Lateral means side. The brain has two halves, and the cortex is clearly divided into two hemispheres. The left and the right. And they are differently connected to the body. The left side of your brain controls parts of the right side of your body, and the right side of the brain controls parts of the left side of your body. So it's very confusing. It's an interesting system because for most purposes, what happens is that they're duplicates. They look pretty much the same, and they're connected across the chasm between them through what's called the corpus callosum, which is a big, thick bundle of fibers that connects the two halves. And both of those are working, but they're working on different sensory systems. And at some point, one of them is going to be more efficient if one of them becomes dominant. And if you concentrate processing of particular kinds of information on one side and make that one in charge, otherwise you're communicating back and forth when you don't need to. So during the second year, the brain decides, in most cases, that either the left side or the right side is going to be dominant. And if the right side is dominant, then you may end up left-handed. Those of us who are right-handed and consistently right-handed have brains that are left side dominant. Because the left side is controlling the right hand. And we're choosing from that point on to concentrate development of particular skills and control of particular skills on one side of the brain or the other. And for some tasks, we're deciding whether we want to do them on one side of the brain or whether we want to involve both sides. And if we involve both sides, then we think differently than people who involve only one side for some tasks. It's important in the second year because it comes along with the development of grammar. Kids who are learning language have a bunch of words and they do them one at a time. And as they get up into the 16, 18 month range, they begin to put two words together and with using rules that they figure out or that they come equipped with. They put words together. And about the same time, they will figure out that they are left-handed or right-handed. If a child does not have a clear left or right side and speech is delayed, or language is delayed, kid may be using lots of one words, we don't worry about it very much. But if the child is fully left or right-handed and is still not developing language, then we begin to worry about it because we know that these two are fairly closely tied together. The choosing of one side to be dominant also improves balance. It allows running, and you have a preferred hand, foot, and an eye, and different functions for each hand and for each foot. And some of you know that you are clearly left-footed when it comes to soccer and are not likely to hit the goal with your left foot, so you always line up the shot so you can use your right, or the opposite, whichever. Some of you can't swing a bat in a coordinated fashion left-handed, but do it quite well right-handed, and some of us can do it both. And some of you know that you have difficulty with some verbal tasks like reading, and that your dominance is mixed. Language problems are one of the correlates of having mixed dominance, which suggests that there's something going on in the brain as the activity in the brain becomes lateralized and permits the development of language and reading skills. Okay. The second major phase that's interesting is that somewhere during the period of 5 to 7 years, and that's the period that marks the distinction between early childhood and middle childhood, it's also the period when we start typically formal instruction. And most cultures begin formal instruction by people who are not parents in the skills that kids are going to need in the particular society. What happens is that the connection between the two halves of the brain and it improves through the corpus callosum. The brain improves in its ability to integrate information that comes in through different senses. And the brain improves its ability to choose outputs and to inhibit impulse and impulsive behavior. So the brain is becoming more integrated and the behavior is becoming more complex and more voluntary. We call that the 5 to 7 shift. So you're integrating the input and output in different systems. You're integrating verbal memory and action, so you can actually tell a kid to do something in 5 minutes. And ideally, you can wait 5 minutes and remember to do it. You have intentional modification of action. So the kid is more aware of what his or her body is doing and can take instruction, which is helpful if you have a coach or a teacher. Okay. So you can do intentional modification. Okay. So those are the two big changes in the way the brain operates and therefore the way the kid operates between birth and puberty would be the next big change. So we have a period of lateralization in the second year and a switch from roughly 5 to 7 years. That's a period when these changes are taking place. Some kids get there earlier, some kids get there later, which is why you see so much variability in kindergarten and first and second grade, and why we say some kids aren't ready for school, because they're slower in integrating the two parts of the brain and going through these changes of the 5 to 7 period. Okay. You paying attention? Yes? Good. Let me find the menu. Nice. All right, here we go. We mentioned in the syllabus that there would be opportunities to acquire some additional points toward your grade with unannounced writing exercises, and so we'd like to inaugurate that process. So here's one. Julie will start passing out response forms. And Larry will find the question. Sure he will. There we go. Okay. There we go. Oh, you can't see it. That's interesting. You can't see it unless I turn down the lights. Is that going to be okay? You can write in the dark, right? Okay. Simple question. Just briefly describe, just on the piece of paper you have, three ways activity is involved in physical development. Okay. Oh, question. Yes. Can you use your notes? Sure. Yeah. You take half and pass them back and all. Sure.
Do you mean the physical activity?
Physical activity? Yes, physical activity. More? No, we need it on our... to put your name on it. Everybody have one? Great, thank you. And when you finish, Julie will be standing at the back to collect them as you go. What? You didn't get them? You didn't yell. And the question is,
describe three ways activity is involved in physical development.